However, the transformation of a number of areas of Raghuan district into a launching pad for the operations of Hadi forces and the Islah Party militias had little effect on the course of the confrontations on the western and southwestern fronts, where the skirmishes declined in the past 2 days. Meanwhile, the Yemeni armed forces were able to make new military progress west of the Khanjar camp, specifically in the Hub and Al-Shaga front of Al-Jawf governorate. The military media center in Sana'a published audio and video documented scenes that showed the army and the popular committees in the area, in addition to showing scores of dead and injured Saudi mercenaries. In the meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Saria, confirmed that the drone air force was able to carry out a massive military operation targeting a training camp of the Saudi Emirati coalition in the Al-Wadi'a area, with 10 Qasif 2K drones targeting the command center, training sites, and sectors. Saria pointed out that the operation, which was documented by video and audio, led to the killing of a Saudi officer and 16 members of Saudi mercenaries, including a number of military leaders. According to military sources in Sana'a, the targeted camp is under the supervision of the Central Military Command in the region and enjoys high protection and advanced technological security via American satellites. Saria made it clear that targeting Al-Wadi'a camp was a message to Washington that will be followed by other messages during the upcoming period of fighting to liberate all of Maghreb. Now to discuss this issue with us from Sydney is author and academic Dr. Tim Anderson. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Anderson. Now, footage of the Yemeni Armed Forces media showed Yemeni Qasif 2K arriving at the scene inside the Al-Wadi'a military camp, which is a very, very important camp on the border with Yemen, while Saudi soldiers and their mercenaries were fleeing. Whoever was left of them fled for their lives. Now, the Yemeni armed forces have been targeting Saudi military bases for a long time now. Why was this operation very significant for the Yemeni armed forces?
It's another step, really, in the Yemeni forces taking over parts of Najran, moving into an area that has been disputed for a long time, but in any case, currently Saudi territory. So there's strong support they have also from some of the people there. So, and the use of the drones that you mentioned, as you said, has been used before against other Saudi military bases.
Well, during the same week, Yemeni army forces launched two missile strikes against the position of Saudi-led militants in Yemen's very strategic central province of Maghreb, which is witnessing right now huge operations. They killed and wounded dozens of those mercenaries. Many reason might be behind the choice to take the time to liberate Maghreb, because it's been over 5 months now that the operation of Maghreb had started. However, if you want to break down the situation in this major city which is bordering Saudi Arabia, why do you think that the Yemeni armed forces led by the resistance forces of Ansarullah are taking their time to liberate Maghreb?
I don't think it's completely correct to say that they're taking their time. They've actually made a number of statements to say that we're going to, you know, move very quickly, and they wanted to move very quickly. But as you say, it's an extremely heavy battle, and it's the biggest stakes in the north of Yemen, really, because this is the one base that the Hadi so-called government based in Riyadh has. In other words, everything that the Saudis have been doing has been trying to reinforce this one significant base on the ground, and if and when Ansarullah-led forces take Maghreb, that is going to change the complexion in the entire region, basically. And as you say, there's been heavy battle. There's been a lot of airstrikes on the forces coming in from the west, and the Yemeni revolutionary government is using ballistic missiles also against their targets there. I've read that there's been thousands of casualties there. So I don't think their aim is to slow it down. In fact, they are making some moves in other parts of the country at the same time, but this is a really the big battle in the north of Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Well, one very interesting thing happened last week was the breaking of an agreement that happened between the Yemeni armed forces and the biggest tribes of Maghreb, because the mercenaries of Saudi Arabia broke that agreement and started shooting from those specific areas after long talks happened between Ansarullah and these tribes, and they all agreed that they should not fight. Do you think that Mohammed bin Salman is now trying to maneuver something new to maybe bring new enemies for Ansarullah to the table?
Well, there's always the aim to try and divide and carve out sections of the country. I mean, you know, that Hadi himself was the one who was trying to move back to a six-part partition of the country under Saudi direction. So they'll keep doing that, but I think there's a measure of desperation coming from Riyadh now, because they are losing on so many fronts, and the revolutionary government is making incursions into the south now at the same time. So they are fighting on more than one front.
Well, the Swedish foreign minister landed in Riyadh last week, where she met with Saudi foreign minister Faisal bin Farhan, and for God knows what reason, she met with Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, the ousted Yemeni president. Now, she tweeted that the discussions were concerning the peace efforts in Yemen for bilateral issues and for humanitarian issues as well, and humanitarian rights. Now, Saudi Arabia is still bombing Yemen. It's blockading the country, aerial, sea, land blockades, and it's sending even more mercenaries to occupy the country. What peace efforts is she talking about?
Well, the problem is that there is a very bad Security Council resolution, I think it's 2216 from 2015, which frames the whole conflict as though what they call the Houthis are the problem, basically an outside problem, and somehow enshrines Hadi as legitimate president of Yemen. Now, Hadi had an interim role in 2012 through 2014, but somehow this Security Council resolution from 2015 has enshrined forever the role of this exiled junta in Riyadh as the legitimate government. And so the language being used, and you see it in the Persian Gulf press and the Western press, the Yemeni government this, the Yemeni government that, they're talking about a regime, or not even a regime, but a group of people in Riyadh, basically, as the Yemeni government. So when other agents, including those, you know, looking at the UN security resolution, come in, there's a very difficult structure there to deal with. And you know, what Ansarullah, the revolutionary government, has said, that they'll agree to a ceasefire if the blockade is lifted, unfortunately is undermined by this very bad Security Council resolution from 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, Oman has been long perceived as a neutral party in a part of West Asia, and has spent the past few weeks attempting to get Saudi Arabia and Yemen to the negotiating table to find an end to the ongoing suffering of the Yemeni people. Now, the Yemeni conditions for any ceasefire, just like you just mentioned, are fixed. They are not negotiable. Ansarullah said it clearly by the movement's leader, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi. He said, lift the siege, halt all forms of aggression, just stop bombing the same place hundreds of times, and end the occupation. I think that these are reasonable. Even if I want to stand by the Yemenis, if I want to look, I want to take a different position and be objective about it, they seem very logical conditions there. What is the next move for Yemen in the event that Mohammed bin Salman just chooses to move forward with the aggression instead of accepting the reality and just giving up on his psychopathic warmongering policies?
It's very difficult. He's in a very difficult situation. Let's say the Saudi rulers are in a very difficult situation because they are losing on several fronts. They're having their own territory incursions into what they consider their own territory, as well as about to lose Marib, which is going to be a very big blow to them. And of course, the Emirates and Israel are in the south, you know, and there's some some movement going on there, let's say, in favor of the revolutionary government. So the Saudis have been suing for peace for some time because they know that they're losing, but they're hanging on to those shreds of so-called legitimacy that the UN gives them, and that their Western backers are hanging on to, really. So, but nevertheless, the Saudis know that they're losing. They've gone to Iran, they've gone to Oman, they're doing talks, they're looking for peace. And in the meantime, as you say, the revolutionary government has put a very reasonable position, and while that's not met, they are simply going ahead with what they're going ahead with, and they're making more progress, basically. And this is, you know, the problem is the legitimacy battle going on internationally is going to try and sheet home responsibility to, you know, their favoured party. And so that's the dilemma in terms of the international debate.
Well, it seems that we are looking ahead to very decisive weeks ahead in the briefing Medvedev and see where things go for the action negotiations to move forward. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tim Anderson, author and academic, for joining us from Sydney to talk about the latest developments in Yemen. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16th, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. If we do not vote because we have complaints, I believe this is not right. This is also an important point. Therefore, I accept the complaints, but do not agree with not participating in the elections because of these complaints. The future government must also take the required steps in this regard. Another point is related to the youth. I think highly of the youth and believe the youth are pioneers in all major issues of the country. Not only are they pioneers concerning the issues, but they also push others forward. The same should happen in the elections. I expect the youth, the dear youth of the country, to encourage people as much as they can go to the ballot boxes to participate in the elections and to be active in this respect, particularly in the case of those who are casting their first vote. In every presidential election, a large portion of the people includes those who are casting their first vote. Their participation in the elections is actually like them celebrating reaching the age of political responsibility. It is actually like a celebration they join for having reached the age of responsibility. The last point I'm going to make at the end of my speech is that I see some want to dishearten the people and cause them to lose hope by making false analysis. We are not surprised at what the enemy does, but inside the country, there are some who say things that make people disheartened and disappointed due to their pessimism and their weak analysis, weak in the real sense of the word. They don't intend to do this, but they are disheartening the people. I say this is wrong. Feeling disheartened and having no hope have no place in our country. Our nation is a strong nation, a determined nation. The foundations of our country are strong. We are a powerful country. In the second phase of the Islamic Revolution statement, I explained, and I have also explained in various speeches, that we are a great nation. We are a powerful country. We have many capabilities, and these capabilities are evident to our enemies as well. Everyone knows this.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The World with Reporters.
Sudan condemns Ethiopia's start of second phase of filling the controversial Nile Dam, warning the move violates existing agreements and threatens security in the region. The warning came after Sudan's Minister of Irrigation and Water Resources received a letter from Ethiopian counterpart informing him of the start of the second filling of the dam during the current rainy season. Despite drums of war appear, the government of Sudan ruled out any military solution to resettle the situation.
I think the military option, to my understanding, is out of question. It's not going to happen, especially for Sudan, because the battle will be in Sudan. And maybe Ethiopia will retaliate if they attack again, maybe they are going to retaliate in Qusair al-Dam or anywhere else, and the areas there will be affected. So, and this is not the solution.
Experts insist that no other option rather than negotiation within the international law is available for Sudan.
The National Court of Justice, which is an organ of the United Nations, according to its rules, no country can take another country to that court unless the country has already agreed to go before the International Court of Justice and definitely Syria would not agree to that. So there is no international legal channel available to the government of Sudan.
Last month, Sudan and Egypt had sent a letter asking the UN Security Council to take up the issue. Talks mediated by the African Union, most recently in the Democratic Republic of Congo, have repeatedly stalled. According to Sudanese authorities, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is being built about 15 kilometers from border with Sudan on the Blue Nile, the source of most of the Nile's water, yet it affects life of 20 million people in this area.
Isaac de Percy, with starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River by Ethiopia, the ball is now on the court of Sudan and Egypt. But as things stand, the two countries are still waiting for an action by the UN. Mohammed Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
The anti-Iran Mujahideen Ekalak organization, considered by many as a dangerous terrorist organization, will hold its annual meeting in Paris on Saturday. The notorious Cairn Academic Edition House, a kind of think tank for universities, published a study about the National Council of Resistance of Iran, NCRI, the umbrella organization of the MKO, with as conclusion, according to objective criteria, the NCRI is without any doubt a sectarian organization. The MKO is, among others, accused of separating children from their parents. So why do French authorities allow them to organize their annual conference?
If Mariam Rajavi is still in France and they still have their rallies every now and then in Paris, it means that the French want to be on both sides of the fence, like all the Europeans. France has an interest of having good relations with Iran. They had Total, which had invested a lot of money then, they'd probably want to go back.
In previous meetings of the MKO in Paris, the group had actively lobbied to obtain the support of mayors and members of parliament. The most visible support comes from French Member of Parliament Habib Meyer, who has the double nationality, Israeli and French. He participates even in marches from the MKO here in 2016. Is there a link between Israel and the MKO terrorist organization?
Mujahideen have been linked closely to Israel. You have a report by two high officials from the CIA, which was publicized by NBC Radio in 2012, which said that the operations to assassinate the scientists and any other clandestine operations, terrorist operations inside Iran, were being planned or had been planned by the Israeli Secret Service and executed by members of the Mujahideen. So the Mujahideen have been working with the Israeli Secret Services ever since that time.
Also, important USA officials spoke at the conference. John Bolton, a former USA national security advisor, Rudolph Giuliani, former mayor of New York, and they received money. USA speakers received $25,000. French speakers received $12,500. Media reports say that the money comes from the CIA, from Mossad, but mainly from Saudi Arabia. Experts say that European Union countries, and France in particular, want to eat from both sides. They tolerate the terrorist group on their territory and seek better relations with Iran, especially for economic reasons. It's not sure that this can work. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Among the events that fall in this period is the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the incident. The U.S. and Europe do not recognize the MKO as a terrorist entity and hold regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania.
The MKO terrorists are puppets of the U.S. that have been trying to harm the Islamic Republic since its establishment. They carried out failed assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei when he was president in 1981. They have killed thousands of Iranians in different terrorist attacks, yet the U.S. and Europe delisted them as a terrorist entity and accommodate them. This shows how insincere are the Americans in their human rights slogans.
Activists here believe the U.S. has not changed its hostile behavior toward Iranians. They refer to the ongoing anti-Iran sanctions as economic terrorism that seeks to fulfill the same goals it failed to achieve, in the 1980s.
The maximum pressure campaign sought to bring Iranians to their knees to finally pit them against the government. But as you see, this plot has failed, like several other conspiracies they hatched against Iran.
The victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution marked the end of decades of U.S. dominance over Iran's economy and its petroleum sector, something which is believed to be the main reason why the U.S. has made so many attempts to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic, including its support for Iraq in its 8 years of war against Iran and its unconditional support for the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group, and today, by unleashing the toughest sanctions that have overshadowed Iran's health sector.
This gathering is held at the former U.S. Embassy in Iran, which is now turned into a museum that showcases documents of Washington's hostile agenda against Iran. Activists here say the U.S. adopts a selective approach towards the issue of human rights, at least in Iran. But they say it's time for the world to know the truth. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An economic crisis came under the spotlight in Lebanon in October 2019 after the then government of Saad Hariri proposed plans to raise new taxes on tobacco, petrol, and voice calls via messaging services such as WhatsApp. The Hariri government sought to drum up more revenue amid a shortage of foreign currency, but the plans led to mass protests against economic turmoil and corruption. Eventually, the plans were called off and the government stepped down, but the financial situation continued to worsen amid the coronavirus pandemic. Hariri's successor, Hassan Diab, also resigned after a deadly explosion at the Beirut port in August 2020 that caused billions of dollars of damage. The Lebanese currency has so far lost more than 90% of its value, and more than half of the population has been sunk into poverty, as the country also faces severe fuel shortages. In the wake of the deepening economic crisis, Diab, who is a caretaker premier now, warned on Tuesday that Lebanon is only days away from what he called a social explosion. Diab, whose country has failed to form a new government in almost 11 months, also urged foreign donors to release financial aid to save the nation and do not link it to the government formation.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
On Monday, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah resistance movement blamed the United States for economic crises. Syed Hassan Nasrallah said Washington is wielding the threat of sanctions against the Lebanese government to prevent it from receiving aid from other countries. Talks over the formation of a new cabinet have stalled as President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri remain at loggerheads over the coming government's makeup and reform agenda. This comes as the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies are at odds with Beirut over the role of Hezbollah in Lebanon's politics. The resistance movement and its allies now hold the majority of parliamentary seats following elections in 2018. Irrespective of the ongoing crisis in Lebanon, the country's main woes are rooted in the power-sharing system, which is a legacy of the French colonialism. Nonetheless, many are worried that the political vacuum and chaos in Lebanon could plunge the Mediterranean nation into a new civil war like the one it experienced for 15 years until 1990.
Julian Assange recently turned 50 years old inside Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison in London. Despite winning his legal battle against extradition to the United States, he remains incarcerated in the UK's most notorious prison while awaiting the US government's appeal. The WikiLeaks co-founder faces 18 charges, 17 under the Espionage Act, for conspiracy to receive, obtain, and disclose classified diplomatic and military documents. But many feel that his real crime was exposing US war crimes to the world. Assange's treatment, which UN rapporteur Niels Melzer described as psychological torture, has caused outrage back in his native country of Australia, where over 600,000 people
have signed a petition calling for his immediate release.
Despite the corporate media running dead on the issue, basically, and not supporting him, there has been a groundswell, and there's been a lot of campaigns. There are regular rallies, and of course, but we rely on the social media and other forms of media because the corporate media has been so locked out, because they have been in lockstep with all of these 8 wars in the Middle East in the last 20 years.
This also prompted Australian MPs from across the political spectrum to issue a statement via video message to US President Joe Biden to drop the espionage charges against the Australian citizen and for the British government to allow him to return home.
Citizens expect us to protect journalists and publishers, not to imprison them or their work.
So far, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has refused to back campaigners' call for his release and said Assange should not receive, quote, special treatment. Press TV spoke to Australian academic Tim Anderson and asked him what he thought of these comments by the Conservative Prime Minister.
Well, unfortunately, we have a long tradition in Australia of governments kowtowing to Washington, and particularly the Conservative ones. The Conservative ones have been huge enthusiasts for doing whatever Washington wants them to do. So, unfortunately, that's a tradition we live with, and it takes an extraordinary amount of pressure to shift them to lift their fingers and do something that Washington might not agree with. But nevertheless, the pressure is being raised here.
The pressure on Joe Biden's administration to drop the charges against Julian Assange is mounting, with not only Australian MPs demanding his release, but also Italian parliamentarians calling for the recognition of his political refugee status. But will any of this sway the US, who seem as determined as ever to extradite the co-founder of WikiLeaks? Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Violence has escalated in Afghanistan since the official declaration in May by U.S. President Joe Biden to withdraw remaining American troops from Afghanistan by September 11. Since then, the Taliban have intensified their attacks on hundreds of district centers across the country, many of these dramatically falling into the hands of the militant group one after another across the nation.
The situation is getting worse day by day. The Taliban have captured several districts and are expanding their hold on most of highways now under their control. Northern provinces are also the scene of a rise in Taliban attacks, but government forces are not confronting them seriously.
Despite Taliban's advance, government officials have described the fall of those districts into the hands of militants as an outcome of a tactical retreat by Afghan troops who have no much support of foreign forces on the ground now. However, the Taliban militant group seemingly doesn't care about what officials in Kabul talks about the reasons of the fall of dozens of districts. Instead, the group is still trying to bring more lands under its sway. But things seem to be not in favor of the Taliban as they expect because of prevailing public anger, as because many Afghans are against the revival of the Taliban rule over the country due to the group's dogmatic ideology, especially when it comes to social liberties. As a matter of fact, locals have formed armed fronts to resist Taliban attacks.
We support public resistance fronts against the Taliban. There is no doubt these forces have created serious obstacles on the way of Taliban and stopping them from gaining more ground. They will defeat the Taliban in close cooperation with our army and police forces if the government honestly supports them.
The move has been fruitful as public uprising forces have retaken several key districts from the Taliban, mainly in northern Tahar and southern Ghazni provinces. The back-to-back fall of districts to the Taliban has also created doubts among locals who say the retreat of Afghan forces from some key districts is unusual. The doubts have raised concerns of a strong revival of Taliban and their possible secret deals. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Said Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
هي التي تقدم.
سير نصالله highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed that there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern-day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. It's the occupation is illegal by law, by international law, and this is why on the other side it's very legal for the Palestinian to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine, to free Palestine, and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression. The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayyid Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The latest Israeli airstrike over the Gaza Strip has left several families homeless. In northern parts of the enclave, tents have replaced high-rise buildings leveled by Israeli airstrike. Abu Muhammad, a father of 11 children, has his three-story building bombed. He is now living with his family in his damaged home with nowhere to go.
They bombed our house with no prior notice. We had to escape the streets, leaving all of our belongings in the house. People helped us and offered shelter in armed wire schools. When the war was over, some people went back to their homes, but I felt miserable because I had nowhere to go. We have no way but to live in the tents.
Ala, a Gazan student, has all her belongings damaged when the Israeli regime bombed their home. She is now not able to pursue her studies due to the chaos she is caught in.
We thought we were secured in our home, but they hit us. When I got back here to see what happened to the home, I found my belongings all damaged. My laptop, books, and clothes are all ruined. Now I'm not able to continue my studying. I just want to live peacefully and concentrate on making a better future, and this can never happen while Israeli regime keeps bombing us.
The Gaza Housing Ministry says 1,800 housing units have been totally destroyed and 17,000 partially damaged in the Gaza Strip. Palestinians are still recovering the 2014 war in Gaza that caused huge destruction, and the latest onslaught increased the tragedy. Umm Muhammad visits the building that housed her family for more than 10 years, crumpled down by Israeli airstrikes.
When I first saw my home destroyed, I could not stand up on my feet anymore. Nothing is left safe. We were preparing new units for our sons Mohammed and Ahmed to maintain their life, and now, after 10 years of hard work and saving to redesign this home, everything is destroyed.
The scene of displaced families have turned into a familiar scene in Gaza, as most of Gazans have lost their homes in Israeli airstrikes. Many of them are now camping on the rafters of their homes with nowhere else to go. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Huh?
Hansa Grundberg, known as the ambassador of the European Union to Yemen, is now the UN Special Envoy for the Arab country. He succeeded Martin Griffiths of the United Kingdom, who was appointed in February 2018 but failed to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen.
The large number of UN appointments will not change anything as long as there is no will to separate the humanitarian situation from the military and political issues. Changing the UN envoy will return the political process to zero because he will bring new agenda that will certainly serve the US and the Saudi-led coalition, including obtaining new funding for the operational budget of the UN organizations.
The member of Yemen Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, says that the new UN envoy for Yemen won't bring anything new as long as the Saudi war and the blockade persist. He has called on the UN at its Security Council to stop supporting the US and Britain and start supporting permanent peace.
The recent UN resolutions have proven that the funding that the United Nations obtains from Saudi Arabia affects its decisions. If Yemen has provided funding to the UN envoy and his organization, the international body would have taken decisions in favor of the Yemenis. I believe that there will be no change in the political process, as the United Nations is not serious about committing to the principles and laws on which it was first established, which has become worthless now. All Yemenis have lost their confidence in the UN and all those who follow it.
Millions of Yemenis have been under a tight blockade since March 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen to reinstate a friendly regime there. The war has brought Yemen to what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Observers say neither Grundberg nor anybody else can put an end to the suffering of millions of Yemenis as long as the UN puts a blind eye to Saudi atrocities. That's due to the kingdom's funding for the world body. They believe that Yemeni military operations are the only way to push Riyadh toward a political solution. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
On June 10, 2021, 2,400 liters of firefighting water containing PFAS were accidentally released from the U.S. Army oil storage facility into Uruma City and other nearby locations, according to Ryuko Shimpo and Okinawan News Agency. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Pat Elder, peace and environment activist. This article is published under the heading Deadly June 10th Spill of Toxins from U.S. Military Base in Okinawa Could Sicken and Kill Thousands. Stay tuned for more. On June 10, 2021, 2,400 liters of firefighting water containing PFAS were accidentally released from the U.S. Army oil storage facility into Uruma City and other nearby locations, according to Ryuko Shimpo, an Okinawan news agency. The Okinawa Defense Bureau said the toxic materials flowed out of the base due to heavy rain. The concentration of PFAS in the release is unknown and the army is not forthcoming. The spill is believed to have emptied into the Tengan River and the sea. During past investigations conducted by the prefecture, the Tengan River has been found to have high concentrations of PFAS. Poisonous releases of toxic chemicals by the U.S. military are commonplace in Okinawa. Consider how the latest spill is treated in the Okinawan press. On the evening of June 11th, the Defense Bureau reported the incident to the prefectural government, Urumo City, Kanatake Town, and the fishermen's cooperatives concerned and asked the USI to ensure safety management, prevent recurrence, and promptly report the incident. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs conveyed its regrets about the incident to the US side on June 11. The Defense Bureau, the city, the government, and the prefectural police confirmed the site. Ryuko Shinpo has inquired about the details of the incident to the U.S. military, but as of 10 p.m. on June 11th, there has been no response. If the army responds, we know what they're likely to say. They will say they are concerned about the health and safety of Okinawans and are committed to ensuring safety management and making sure there is no recurrence. That's the end of the story. Deal with it, Okinawa. Okinawans are considered second-class Japanese citizens. The Japanese government has repeatedly demonstrated it cares little about the health and safety of Okinawans in the face of repeated toxic releases from U.S. bases. Although the small island of Okinawa comprises just 0.6% of Japan's land mass, 70% of land in Japan that is exclusive to U.S. forces is located there. Okinawa is about one-third the size of Long Island, New York, and has 32 American military facilities. Okinawans eat a lot of fish that are contaminated by exorbitant levels of a particularly deadly variety of PFAS that flows into surface waters from the American bases. It is a crisis on the island due to the high concentration of American military installations. Eating seafood is the primary source of human ingestion of PFAS. On April 17, 2020, a fire suppression system in an aircraft hangar at Marine Corps Air Station Futenma discharged a massive volume of toxic firefighting foam. Foamy soots poured into a local river, and cloud-like clumps of foam were seen floating more than 100 feet above the ground and settling in residential playgrounds and neighborhoods. The Marines were enjoying a barbecue in a massive hangar outfitted with an overhead foam suppression system that apparently discharged when the smoke and heat were detected. Okinawa Governor Denny Tamaki said, "I truly have no words," when he learned that a barbecue was the cause of the release. And what would be an appropriate response from the governor now? He could say, for example, the Americans are poisoning us while the Japanese government is willing to sacrifice Okinawan lives for the never-ending U.S. military presence. 1945 was a long time ago, and we have been victims since then. Clean up your mess. United States forces Japan and get out. When pressed to comment, David Steele, commander of Futenma Air Base, shared his words of wisdom with the Okinawan public. He informed them that if it rains, it will subdue. Apparently, he was referring to the bubbles, not the propensity of the foams to sicken people. A similar accident occurred at the same base in December 2019 when a fire suppression system mistakenly discharged the carcinogenic foam. In early May 2021, the Okinawan government announced the groundwater in the area around the Marine Corps base contained a concentration of 2,000 ppt of PFAS. Some U.S. states have regulations in place that prohibit groundwater from containing more than 20 ppt of PFAS, but this is occupied Okinawa. A report by the Okinawa Defense Bureau said that the foam releases at Futenma had almost no effect on humans. Meanwhile, Ryuko Shimpo newspaper sampled river water near the Futenma base and found 247.2 ppt of PFOS and PFOA in the river. Seawater from Makimanto fishing port contained 41 ng per 1 of the toxins. The river had 13 variables of PFAS that are contained in the military's aqueous film-forming foam. So, what does it mean that the water has 247.2 parts per trillion of PFAS? It means people are getting sick. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says surface water levels that exceed 2 ppt pose a threat to human health. The PFOS in the foams widely bioaccumulate in aquatic life. The primary way people consume these chemicals is by eating fish. Wisconsin recently published fish data near Turks Air Force Base that shows PFAS levels remarkably close to the concentrations reported in Okinawa. This is about human health and the extent to which people are being poisoned through the fish they eat. In 2013, another accident at Kadena Air Base spread 2,270 liters of fire extinguishing agents out of an upper hangar and into the storm drains. A drunk Marine activated the overhead suppression system. The recent Army accident released 2,400 liters of the poisonous foam. In early 2021, the Okinawan government reported that the groundwater outside the base contained 3,000 ppt of PFAS, groundwater drains into surface air, which then flows to the sea. The stuff doesn't just disappear, it continues to run out of the base and the fish are poisoned. The Army's Kin 1 petroleum oil, the lubricant storage facility in Uruma City, is immediately adjacent to the pier, which is used to receive different types of weapons and ammunition. According to the commander of Fleet Operations Okinawa, Tengan Pier is a popular off-base spot for surfers and swimmers. Located in Tengan Bay on the Pacific Ocean side of Okinawa, this particular spot offers one of the highest concentrations of marine life found anywhere in this region. That's just swell, except for one problem. U.S. military activity threatened the continued health of that very marine life and the marine life of the ocean. In fact, the new base construction in Hanoko threatens the ecosystem of coral reefs, the world's first extinct ecosystem. Nuclear weapons may once again be stored in Hanoko if the base is ever completed. Kin 1 receives, stores, and issues all aviation fuel, automotive gasoline, and diesel fuel used by the United States forces on Okinawa. It operates and maintains a 100-mile petroleum pipeline system that reaches from Futenma Marine Corps Air Station in the south of the island through Kadena Air Base to Kin 1. This is the aorta of the American military presence in Okinawa. Military fuel depots like this around the world are known to have used vast quantities of PFAS chemicals since the early 1970s. Commercial fuel depots have largely stopped using the deadly foams, switching to equally capable and environmentally friendly fluorine-free foams. Takahashi Toshio is an environmental activist who lives adjacent to the Futenma Marine Corps base. His experience in fighting to control noise levels from the base provides a valuable lesson in the necessity for resisting the Americans who are ruining his homeland. He serves as the secretary of the Futenma U.S. Air Base Bombing Lawsuit Group. Since 2002, he has helped to pursue a class action lawsuit to end the noise pollution caused by U.S. military aircraft. The court ruled in 2010 and again in 2020 that the noise caused by the operation of U.S. military aircraft is illegal and beyond what is considered legally tolerable. That the Japanese government is also responsible for the damage caused to the residents and most financially compensate their residents. Since the Japanese government does not have the authority to regulate the operation of U.S. military aircraft, Takahashi's appeal for a flight injunction was rejected, and the damage caused by the aircraft noise continues unabated. A third lawsuit is currently pending in Okinawa District Court. It is a large class action lawsuit with more than 5,000 plaintiffs claiming damage. In the recent army case in Uruma 3, the government of Japan, that is the government of Okinawa, is also unable to investigate the cause of the contamination. Takahashi explained, it has been shown that PFAS contamination causes cancer and can affect fetal development and cause disease in small children. So investigating the cause and cleaning up the contamination is essential in order to protect the lives of residents and fulfill responsibility to future generations. Takahashi says he has heard that progress is being made in the U.S., where the military has investigated PFAS contamination and has assumed some degree of responsibility for the cleanup. This is not the case with U.S. troops stationed overseas, he argues. Such double standards are discriminatory and disrespectful to the host countries and to the regions where U.S. troops are stationed and cannot be tolerated, he said.
What came to look like a never-ending natural or partially natural disaster, mankind finally found a way to control once again. And Iran has been among the few countries to attempt making a vaccines for COVID-19, a global disease none were exempt from. Coviran Barakat, among others, is a vaccine made by Iran despite sanctions. It's now into its third trial phase, and test subjects are coming in for phase three's third visit of five to check for this corona vaccine's effects and after effects. To see how things are looking and under what conditions the country's gotten this far, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Shiraz, Isfahan, Mashhad and Bushehr are behind in completing phase three of the clinical trials among cities designated. Thus far, Coviran Barakat clinical trials, which began in late December, have gone as such. 20,000 volunteers, no less, have received the first round of vaccine inoculations, and over 11,000 have received the second round too. I'll be popping into Eram Hotel Visitation Center to talk to volunteers to see what their visits are for, what made them volunteer for a trial jab in the first place, and how they felt after the jab.
My
My brother first introduced this vaccine, telling me that they're testing it during the human trial phase. We volunteered as a family and got here. We took the first jab on May 22nd and the second one on June 19th. We're here for the blood test. They test our antibody or something, I'm not quite sure, but they said during the second stage, which is a week to 10 days from now, they'll announce the results. They're saying because of the trials, some people were administered vaccines and others only placebos. Those who were given placebos are later vaccinated. I'm waiting to see what I was given. I and my daughter and son got COVID. They had a mild illness, but mine was very severe. Because I go